Aloha and welcome to the Wednesday edition of The Conversation. There's often a vast gulf between the creative artist and the creative outlets, support, and education the artist needs. All the talent in the world won't help you unless you can harness that creative energy, learn your chosen craft, and use what you have learned to make some opportunities for yourself. Creative Lab Hawaii, which is part of the state's Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism's Creative Industries Division, builds a bridge between the artist and the outlet through programs like the one coming up in September, a five-day music immersive program connecting songwriters with the film and television industry. Georgia Skinner is the chief officer of DBED's Creative Industries Division, founder of Creative Lab Hawaii. She's with us in our studio. Hi, Georgia.
Hi. Aloha. Thank you for having me in today.
What's the idea behind these labs, these programs?
Well, thank you for asking. I mean, Creative Lab really was born out of an idea that we need to connect a pathway for our artists, whether they're filmmakers, music makers, or even fashion designers, with those industry clusters where they can expand their work and be able to monetize the work in a way that will make them successful entrepreneurs. So basically, it is an answer to that age-old question. It's not, I just need money and financing to make my film.
Right.
That's only part one, right? It's like, how do you sustain this as a career?
Mm-hmm.
And so Creative Lab builds that pathway of access to mentors who are from the industry, building those business relationships to advance their careers. And there's some great examples already. The Music Immersive, which is managed by the Hawaii Songwriting Festival, managed by Charles Brotman, who is, of course, a Grammy and Hoku winner. We couldn't have found a better a person to manage it because not only of his sensitivity to the industry here, but also because he understands why we need to connect with the outside world, and global is where it is today.
There's an awful lot of good work that, you know, gets to the point of fulfillment as good work, but doesn't find an audience. It just sort of dies a morning. And you think by creating your masterpiece, you've done it, right?
Yeah, but it's really about being that 360-degree entrepreneur where, you know, how do I manage myself when I do have a failure? Or my film only screened at HIFF, for example, and I really want Netflix to pick it up. How do I do that?
Yeah.
So Creative Industries really is about the business of the arts and helping our creative entrepreneurs statewide, of which there are 52,000, help to connect them to these industry clusters. And I just couldn't be prouder of the work that not only the artists are doing, but the fact that the mentors are donating such great time. And, you know, they're a pretty stellar group themselves.
Do artists in general tend to be less aware of industry clusters than they might need to be?
Well, I think that it's important to open doors for music, for example, in these new areas of film, television, and video game. It's an important pathway for opportunity and also a way to monetize the work and protect your IP. So you get to learn not only how to take an existing work that you wrote that you love and get it to new ears, you know, and those decision makers that are the music supervisors, which is the group that you want to reach, who are placing these things in film and these works in film and television and game. Those are the ears you want, and those are the ears that we're delivering in a hands-on mentorship way through Creative Lab at Hawaii Songwriters Festival this September.
A lot of musicians in the last couple of decades have been finding out that the boat has sunk beneath them, right? You know, they thought they were going to make money by making their CD. Whoops, can't do that anymore.
Yeah, the whole model, you know, everything is turned upside down, which is the greatest time for opportunity.
Yeah. If you look at it that way.
Oh, yeah. It's hard. It's hard having grown up in a recording industry family and, you know, being a sound mixer myself. I think that, you know, seeing the industry go through the ups and downs, I believe that there has never been a better time, though, for artists, especially here in Hawaii. I think our remoteness is an advantage, not necessarily a disadvantage, and that the touring that our artists do and the fact that, you know, slack key musicians have been on the road in Europe and, you know, all over the globe, that Japan's and the constituents there that really love our music and our hula and everything about the culture helps to round out a much brighter business model for our artists today than perhaps we had in the past.
Well, a lot of older musicians probably aren't even aware that they could sell their song to a video game company. I mean, we barely know what a video game is.
Yeah, and the keyword there is license. Don't sell outright.
But oh, there you go. See? Already
hang on to those rights. Yeah. We had an example of one of our artists in the current music immersive, Kimye Minor, who is just a tremendous talent and doing so much of the first immersive program. Kimye, Isaac, Charles, and others. Out of that program, five songs were licensed by one by a major industry conglomerate, entertainment powerhouse that I can't say the name of. They do have a hotel here. But anyway, and I think that there are so many other opportunities that these five songs have brought to the artists here in Hawaii. And one of them, you know, Kimye is a great example of how she is giving back, how she was able to, rather than sell something outright, negotiate with a company here in Hawaii to be able to license that work. So she maintains 100% of that intellectual property. And that's what Creative Industries DBED is about. It's about showing people how to do that and navigate that world so that you don't have to necessarily leave home to be able to do your craft and get paid for it, and paid for it well.
The history of music in particular as a business is full of stories of people who have sold the rights to their publishing. I mean, Paul McCartney sold the rights to Beatles songs, you know, much to his, you know, anguish later on, right? It's easy to get caught without knowing how it all works.
But I think that's what Creative Lab does, is it gives you not only the opportunity to work in small pods with a very small group of people that are a music supervisor, an amazing songwriter who've written for film and TV specifically, and then possibly a client like someone from Starz Network, Fox Broadcasting, Disney Digital, all these people converging in Kona to help raise the level of opportunity for export of this music and to see it placed in something that we will hear soon, maybe in the fall.
Yeah.
On television and in video game, it's a little bit different. And we're excited about seeing more composers come forward as well. So right now we're focused on singer-songwriters.
Well, Georgia, you refer to a music supervisor. What is that? What is a music supervisor?
A music supervisor is part of a team that works on any production, whether it's a feature film or a television series, a television special, Netflix production.
Find me some music for my movie.
Yes, and sometimes they come in very early. In the case of Descendants, for example, that's a good example of, you know, Don DeBastone, who was the music supervisor, coming in early, working with the director, working with us to identify artists that they wanted to do on that all-Hawaiian soundtrack, which was a first. And music supervisors, for example, Liza Richardson from and her collaborator from Hawaii Five-O, we integrate those kind of folks into the Hawaii Songwriters Festival, and Creative Industries has been doing that for many years. But now working with a music supervisor in the room to create a song that's specific for a project, that's kind of unheard of. I don't know that there's any other music accelerators in the U.S. or anywhere else, maybe in Europe, that are doing what we're doing here in Hawaii.
Because a lot of times the music supervisor chooses a song that somebody wrote about an entirely different subject, kind of grafts it onto the movie. That's been how it's been done up to now. So this could really be a new sort of a new paradigm. Yeah.
It is. And, of course, you know, royalties come back in every time it's aired, it's licensed. So that is the gift that keeps on giving, and that's the best way for us to be able to extend the work of our artists and get them known around the world in addition to touring and downloads. You have to do it all, but this is a bright new pathway for the future, I think.
So license it, don't sell it.
That's right. License, do not sell.
Okay. Duly noted, Georgia.
Oh, sorry.
Thanks a lot. Georgia Skinner is the chief officer of DBED's Creative Industries Division and the founder of Creative Lab Hawaii. The Music Immersive will be held on Hawaii Island at the Hupuna Prince Hotel from September 11th to 15th, following the Hawaii Songwriting Festival. We'll be right back.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, food is both business and it's fun. We'll talk with a globally recognized leader in food business innovation next. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a denizen of Hawaii's coastal waters. It's found on coastlines from the Hawaiian chain to Midway Atoll and is easily identified by its distinctive coloration. Seen from above, it's black with a kind of polka dot pattern of white dots across its six-foot-wide back. From below, it's a brilliant white. These fish are able to launch themselves into the air, breaking the ocean's surface and twisting in mid-flight. They're often seen by divers, who are cautioned not to touch the long whip-like tail, which has barbed spines at its tip. They feed by digging in sand for clams and oysters, locating their chosen meals by sensing electrical fields beneath the surface. We're looking today for their Hawaiian name, which is translated as magnificent or elegant bird. A quick reminder, because you're listening to a recorded rebroadcast of The Conversation, we won't be taking your calls this evening. You can always call during our live broadcasts at 11 a.m.
Aloha. I'm Anders Osborne from New Orleans, Louisiana. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Cooper House is executive director and a founder of the Rutgers University Food Innovation Center. He's worked internationally on food business incubation and acceleration. Mr. Cooper House was brought to town by the Hawaii Agriculture Foundation thinking his global experience with startups, family-run companies, and innovation in the food sector just might find some traction here. Welcome, Lou.
Aloha. Thank you for having me.
Oh, so glad you've come to town. Could you quickly give us an overview of your field? It's global.
That's correct. So at Rutgers University, we started a program over 15 years ago that really has become a model for really supporting entrepreneurship in communities, not just in New Jersey, but can be replicated around the world. We're quite excited to see some of that transform here in Hawaii. But what it's all about is really giving entrepreneurs the tools that they need. This includes professional development support and mentoring to really make sure that their idea that they have is truly consumer-driven. There's a market for it, and we can validate that as well. But we also can support them with product development and quality assurance and labeling and all the various resources they need. In addition to that, they need a facility to produce the product. Mm-hmm. So these are all the tools. So it really is creating what we call an incubation program, but it's really incubating a company, an entrepreneur, all the way from their initial stages all the way through to their ultimate graduation when they're actually independent on their own.
Well, geez, I mean, you could do this for any kind of product, screws or anything else, but this happens to deal with food, which makes it so much fun.
Absolutely. Especially here in Hawaii, the food industry – there's such a tremendous thirst for local products, not just by the local population, but for the tremendous amount of tourists that are here. And we could actually expand that industry dramatically and also displace the amount of imports that are coming here by really giving, the tools that entrepreneurs need. And there's such a market for that and also can be exported to the mainland as well.
Okay, so you've come and you've talked to a lot of people with maybe some budding ideas. What have you seen here in Hawaii that's got some potential?
Well, there's so many different ideas, whether it's farmers that want to do value-added agricultural products.
What kind of products might be good for that?
So it could be even a farmer doing tropical fruits that wants to do juices or kimchi or sauces or jams. Or it could be an entrepreneur that might have some idea that wants to maybe source local raw materials. But it's also retailers that want to have more local products in their stores, or restaurants that want to take their great selling menu items and maybe also make them available now in a packaged form where consumers could actually take that great taste home with them.
Could you give us some examples of people or places you've worked with, products?
I've had my initial opportunity here in the state was working at the at Maui, at the University of Hawaii Maui College, working with their Maui Food Innovation Center. And they've actually had a series of several dozen companies that they've mentored through a program, again, giving them access to resources and helping them launch their business.
Oh, really? So what kinds of companies are these?
There's companies whose products range from raw bars to cookies to great sauces, just a wide array of packaged products.
Uh-huh. Now, have you seen any place where actually consumer demand ends up changing what is an agricultural system, you know, that really has our land locked up and everything else? I'm just wondering if consumer demand can reach backwards and do some of that change.
It's true that we're in a really unique time for the food industry. So literally in the last 4 years, there's been an actual huge spike. In fact, the New York Times had a headline a few years back, I think it was back in 2013, that said, what if the next best thing in tech does not arrive on your smartphone or in the cloud? What if it lands on your plate? And there's been a tremendous thirst for venture capital to get into the food industry and support some of these startups. We're seeing a lot of growth in particular in plant-based foods, supporting the needs of consumers, millennials, but people of all ages who want to reduce their meat consumption. But at the same time, we're also seeing lots of opportunities in value-added meats and poultry products, too.
Right.
So they're just – but the consumers, to your point, are demanding more experiential products. They're seeing food not as a product but an experience.
What do you mean by that? What could that mean?
Well, it's the same logic to some of the larger brand coffee houses. You know, people stand in line. They want that experience, the smell, the sound, the flavor that comes through with great coffee. So picture that experience, and now we're the experience of a product, that the aloha that you can take home with you. So I think that we're really seeing just a great amount of growth, especially in Hawaiian-branded products.
Mm. How do you see these kinds of actually even healthier foods becoming more available more widely, actually becoming affordable?
I think as they can certainly become more available through these business incubation programs that I'm describing, again, providing the tools. So it's really giving the access to both the talent that is required. It's so complex to be in the food industry. Now there's new food safety regulations. Mm. It's very challenging. So so the entrepreneurs not only need a great idea, but they also need, the right kind of talent to support them, the expertise, the professional mentoring that's required. Then they need a facility where they can produce it. Then they need capital to grow their business. So we're trying to create here in Hawaii is this aggregation of resources, a cluster-based approach to really bring all of us together to support this food industry. So it's a food innovation hui of really bringing us all together, and recognizing there's a continuum that's required from the infant. It's a bit like baby food, the infant food to the toddlers to the graduates.
So you're saying somebody with an idea or a product, somebody who maybe a farmer would come with and enter the system.
Correct.
With that idea, with that raw material.
Exactly.
I mean, say that you were tasked with growing Hawaii's agricultural sector, both for local consumption and for export. What would you do?
So I think we have to recognize that there's so many different types of products that consumers are looking for. And what I'm really trying to help develop here is this incubation model, to really put under one roof this continuum of resources that really helps companies at their very initial early stage days, and frankly may tell them their idea may not be that sound, and let's not waste your money. Let's fail fast and think about something differently to want them to be successful. So not all ideas are necessarily great ones, but we need to have that type of talent to really provide that guidance and then help them evolve to the various steps of their growth.
Where would that happen here? Through the university or?
So university is quite interested. The state is quite interested. And the private sector is quite interested. Mm-hmm. So I'm really excited and motivated that there is great interest here. And I'm really here working with their...
It would be a standalone facility, maybe.
It could be, yes. Huh. So the public and private sector, we're all working together trying to... And I'm here to really help support that effort, to really find just how this can be accomplished.
I see. Do you see any particular benefits for Hawaii being as isolated as it is? I mean, we're familiar with people going over the litany of, challenges. But might there be any benefits for us in this particular sector, food, business innovation?
There's a huge benefit. Not only are we isolated and we need to have more resiliency and more locally grown products for our own sustainability, but we could clearly create higher paying jobs and a much more robust economy with a much stronger food sector, preserving farmland by preserving farming.
So it's a part of a whole land use and lifestyle.
Absolutely.
Integration.
It's a perfect storm. Consumers want it. The investors are happy to invest in it. And the farmers really need to really evolve into value-added products to really sustain their businesses and livelihood.
And this certainly is a moment where it's still possible to save some farmland.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
We've been talking with Lou Cooperhouse. He's the founder and director of the Rutgers University Food Innovation Center, brought here to plant ideas and maybe start a little something by the Hawaii Agriculture Foundation.
This Week in This American Life. Long before she was Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos volunteered as a mentor at a public school for years.
And there she was in her $1,000 suit and her really pretty shoes. And I just thought how odd she looked. She just looked so out of place.
What those years as a volunteer tell us about Betsy DeVos this week.
Hear This American Life, Saturday at 1 p.m.
The Honolulu Prosecutor's Office has pointed with pride to its Makiki Safe House in a building whose purchase is now being looked at by a federal grand jury. At issue is the $1 million profit the building's owner, described as a politically active real estate investor, made on the sale. Nick Gruby has the story in today's Civil Beat Reality Check. Hi, Nick. Thanks for talking with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
We've heard, as I said, the prosecutor office has been quite proud of what it has done with this Makiki Safe House. But this is something different, isn't it?
Yeah, this is something that's completely different. The Safe House actually used to be called the Family Justice Center.
Right.
It actually changed its name to the Safe House after there was some criticism of how the facility was operating as a shelter for abused women. But the property transaction was something that didn't really get a lot of attention until now when federal investigators began asking questions about the circumstances surrounding it, and in particular the $1 million profit that the sellers seemed to make on it.
Well, this is a sale that was originally touted, I think the phrase goodness of my heart came in at one point. It was touted as a kind of a community benefit, almost a charitable contribution. But $1 million is a lot to make in a year, isn't it?
It is. I think it was a little bit eyebrow-raising for a lot of folks who looked at it, including the federal investigators. Assistant U.S. Attorney Michael Wheat purportedly asked Pamela Tamashiro, who was the director of the Safe House and who sort of got it up and running, whether or not she thought there was anything peculiar about that profit, and she described it as, quote, lucky to Mr. Wheat.
The head of the U.S. attorney, Mr. Wheat.
Yes, he's the gentleman who is running the federal grand jury investigation into alleged corruption and abuse of power within Hawaii's law enforcement agencies.
Well, Nick, one of the interesting things about this story is that it's an extension of the Chief Ke Aloha mailbox investigation. It seems like a long way away from there, but it's an indication of the scope, I guess, of the investigation, yeah?
That's right. I mean, the thing to remember is that the mailbox investigation or the mailbox allegations are what sort of opened up the door for the U.S. Attorney's office to walk in mm-hmm. and start sniffing around. And they actually have quite broad authority when it comes to investigating alleged criminal activity here. So while it began with allegations that former police chief Louis Ke Aloha and his wife Catherine, a city prosecutor, had framed a family member to gain the upper hand in a legal dispute over money, it's since taken a lot of different turns, this one involving the safe house being the latest.
This is the kind of thing that defense attorneys are prone to refer to as a fishing expedition, wouldn't you think?
I mean, some would say it's a fishing expedition, sure. But others might say that the investigators are simply following the leads where the facts take them. Mm-hmm. And just because somebody is brought in for questioning or a particular topic is discussed at the grand jury doesn't mean that there is necessarily criminal involvement or intent around that issue. In some cases, it could be a curiosity and that's it, and where more evidence and more fact-finding might find that something criminal or bad had not actually occurred. So it could be exculpatory.
Well, just to circle back to the topic of the day, this is a property that was purchased for $4.5 million and then sold to the city for $5.5 million a year later, right?
Well, that's when the deal actually closed. But the deal had been in the works for a long time. And in fact, the director of the safe house had taken a tour of the property along with the ultimate seller to the city before that seller, Donna Walden, officially owned the property, which I think a lot of people might consider curious.
Well, we'll keep track of this going forward, Nick. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Nick Gruby.
Marcia Gibson spent part of her childhood in Kaka'ako in the late 50s and has written a popular kind of conversational history of the area, Kaka'ako as we knew it, out on Mutual Publishing. We've got her here with us today, and Herbert Kobayashi. His parents owned the store that became the Kimura Store, a recognized historic site that stands on Queen and Kamani Streets today, on the Mauka side. Marcia, would you start out first, please? Introduce Kaka'ako to some of its new inhabitants.
On the whole, Kaka'ako was known to be a rough district. People were afraid to even go into that neighborhood, you know. But I think one of the reasons is because of the boxers. We had some champion amateur boxers, and a couple even became pro.
Right.
So, yeah.
What period was this?
This was probably in the 30s and 40s. Mm-hmm. And but to the insiders, people who lived there, we weren't even aware that other people thought we were so tough, rough, and tough, you know, especially my generation. But the generations before me actually were rough and tough.
Oh, see, now there's you calling that.
Yeah.
But how did these boxers get started? Why in that neighborhood?
Well, a lot of it is because two people, Yono Kitagawa, who was a coach the boxing coach, and Akut O'Hara. They wanted to keep the young boys out of trouble. So they taught them how to box, how to play sports like baseball and other sports, and physical fitness.
Mm-hmm. Some of the people that they trained became quite famous, right?
Yes, mm-hmm. Like Boyd Andrade.
Mm-hmm.
He
right.
was a champion boxer.
Right.
Jaime Vasquez, who recently passed away, mm-hmm. sadly.
Yeah.
And Marino Tiwanak. I mean, there were lots of champion boxers.
Is there anyone else from the neighborhood you'd like to introduce us to then?
Oh, yes. One of the people who stands out is Emmy Tomimbang. She wasn't a rough and tough person, right. but she lived on Ohi Street in a rooming house with her dad and eight fishermen.
Right.
And ironically, that rooming house was kitty corner to where the John Burns Medical School is today. Uh-huh. And as you know, Emmy is the daughter-in-law of the late Governor and Mrs. Burns.
Right, yeah.
And the widow of the late Judge James Burns.
Oh, thanks for this update on your historic neighborhood. And thank you for bringing in Herb Kobayashi. Herb, thanks so much for coming by to tell us a little about your experiences in Kaka'ako. It's from way back.
Of course, my experiences go way back. And I especially like to talk about the days before World War II.
Whoa.
Because a lot of hard to find people that can remember that far back. So
just tell us what it looked like in Kaka'ako then.
Nothing like it is now, of course. It consists mostly of residential areas. There were duplexes. They are houses, one family below and one above. I think Marsha lived in a house like that, probably.
No.
And neighborhood grocery stores and fish markets, meat markets. And my family ran one of these places on the corner of Queen and Kamani Street. Kobayashi Shoteng, which became our Kimura store later on. Our Kimura is my brother-in-law of my sister, Grace.
Is that the pink one?
Yes, it's still there now. It's a Hawaii historic site.
Oh, yes.
So it'll never be demolished.
Did you see it as a really dangerous or tough neighborhood, as tough as the reputation?
Not really, because when you're inside of it, it's not like that.
What did it feel
because
like?
Because you know
there?
Everybody, including the bad people, the good people, the troublemakers, and also.
Were there lots of trees in the area?
Yes, a lot of trees now, so very different. But then during World War II, of course, the peripheral areas, like the area between Ward Street and Kalakaua, below Kapiolani Boulevard, before it was just simply a salt marsh area. It was transformed completely. It's where Marukai and the warehouses are?
Used to be a salt marsh.
Yeah.
The Everside of Ward, what was that area like?
Everside, was fairly well developed.
Already.
In a manner that I just talked to you about, residential areas. Mm. And at the most, houses were only, the stores were often two stories high.
What was Mother Waldron Park area like?
Oh, yeah, Mother Waldron Park actually was not there when I started Pohukaina School in the first grade. That was in 1935. Before that, there was a park that was across the street, but it just consisted of kiawe trees and underbrush. Mother Waldron was amazing when that started off. But
I heard there was a sumo mound somewhere in Kaka'ako. Yeah.
Yeah, there was on Kohula Street.
Ah.
And there, along there, they had a sumo place. Also other things like a temple, church temple. And I think, if I remember right, a bathhouse along that.
Oh, really?
Kohula
a fudo?
Street. Yes. Furo, yeah.
Uh-huh. Was it a largely Japanese neighborhood?
Oh, yeah. Oh. That area there was almost completely Japanese. The peripheral areas now along Queen Street, mostly Portuguese families.
Do you remember the breweries in the area? Beer brewing?
The breweries. That was one of those buildings that were there when we moved to Kakaku, along with the fire station.
Car repair, like now?
Oh, no, there weren't any car repair shops. And what, 95% of it was residential areas. You know. Mostly fishermen, by the way. A lot of the people came, worked as fishermen on the sampans that went out from Kiola Basin. Now, the wives and the daughters worked in the cannery.
Which was right across on the Makai side,
yeah.
Right?
And the cannery smokestack is still there yet. It's become a children's center, I believe. And so it was perfect. You know, you got two sources of income coming in.
And you really had workforce housing at that time.
So it's been
so great, Herb, getting a chance to look at the colorful history of Kaka'ako with you. Thank you so much. You really put some color into the black and white pictures we have in our minds so often. And thank you so much, Marcia.
Oh, you're welcome.
Marcia Gibson and Herbert Kobayashi. We're looking forward to Emmy Tomenbaum's machine television special on Kaka'ako is coming up next spring. And they were all partying at the Pohukaina School Kaka'ako reunion last Friday.
Aloha, I'm taiko artist Kenny Endo. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on the HPR mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or Google Play.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, a reporter takes us deep into the Amazon, where a totally isolated Indian tribe is reaching out to civilization.
The Mashko had disappeared into the forest. Now, suddenly, they're coming out. There was a kind of growing consensus and an alarm spreading that perhaps it is the end time for these people.
John Lee Anderson in Peru. That's next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Sunday morning at 9, following Weekend Edition.
In today's backyard quiz, well, it's native to Hawaiian waters, and it's known by a number of names in English. All right, Hawaiian spotted eagle ray, bonnet ray, duckbill ray, and spotted duckbill ray. I know you're starting to get the picture, right? Its shape suggests that of a bird, its angular dorsal fins often described as wings. The comparison goes even further if you're lucky enough to see them breach the ocean's surface and spin in midair. I've never seen that. Mothers have been known to expel their pups in midair, each one of them 10 to 20 inches wide at birth. Newborns must adapt to ocean life quickly. They're a favorite prey of tiger sharks. We asked you their Hawaiian name and told you it meant magnificent or elegant bird. We're guessing the name might have been inspired by those aerial exploits. The Hawaiian name we were looking for is Hihimanu.
And Noe Jim McGowan of Kona not only knew the answer, but he said he just saw one this morning as he swam by the Kona Pier.
Oh, my gosh.
So that's how
some people get to start their mornings that way,
yeah,
Chris.
How serendipitous is that, right?
I would love to see one of these animals actually get up into the air.
I know. We've seen video of it, but spectacular sight that would be.
And then pupping while you're up there. Amazing creatures, these Hihimanu.
The miracle of childbirth, right? That's our backyard quiz for today. If you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
One day in 1973, John Francis decided to stop speaking.
Yeah, but just for one day. But if I had started and someone said, John, you're not going to speak for 17 years, I might not have gone on.
I'm Guy Raz, searching for quiet in a noisy world. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Saturday at 3 p.m.
The interests of the city and county of Honolulu and the neighbor islands have rarely seemed as far apart as they have during the ongoing debate over funding for the Honolulu Rail Project. Our conversation yesterday with Kauai County Council Chair Mel Raposo was a reminder of the difficulty of keeping apparently competing interests aligned. We're asking Honolulu City Council Chair Ron Minor for his perspective. He's on the line with us now. Hi, Council Chair. How are you?
Okay, fine. Thank you.
The Senate has voted to move SB 4 along, and that includes a 1% increase to the transient accommodation tax. Have you been in support of that all along?
Oh, yes. So the city and the more specifically the city council has been very supportive of trying to develop a funding mechanism that will generate sufficient revenues to complete rail construction to Ala Moana Center.
You've also said you said you've committed to completing the rail system all the way to Ala Moana Center. You also said, I'm going to quote from your statement, "I'm also sensitive to the need for better oversight and management of the rail project and its overall cost to the people of Hawaii." What have been your causes for concern about that?
Well, I think the most obvious concern was the fact that HART was way off on their numbers when the state legislature in 2015 voted to extend the excise tax surcharge to 2027 to fund rail. At that time, or during the 2015 session, HART had indicated that that extension would be sufficient to complete rail to Ala Moana Center. And then several months after the close of the 2015 legislative session, HART comes back and says, well, we're about $2 to $3 billion short of what we need to complete rail. So clearly, HART's credibility has been called into question, and it's clear that based on the experience of 2015, that HART has had to do a better job of developing their cost projections. So, in that regard, the city council members share the concern of legislators that we need to exercise better oversight over HART with respect to their implementing cost containment measures and with respect to their management of the rail project going forward.
Well, you've as a council, you've had to vote more than once on incomplete or inadequate information, right?
You know, we've tried to get the numbers from HART, and it has to some extent been frustrating. But I think that under HART's leadership, Director Murphy, who replaced Director Grabowskis, that there has been a more determined and focused effort on the part of HART to try to monitor costs and to manage the project better. So going forward, we're optimistic, we're hopeful that the project will be managed more cost-effectively in the future.
Well, now the Senate has voted to move the bill along, and it includes that 1% increase to the transient accommodations tax, and that's borne by all the neighbor islands, right?
That's correct.
Let me play you a soundbite. I spoke to your counterpart on Kauai, Council Chair Raposo, yesterday. I asked him what the mood of his electorate was in regard to this whole thing with the transient accommodation tax. Here's what he said to me.
What this has done, it has created this hatred. This discomfort in our constituents about their rail project, where, you know, I don't want to mess with Honolulu's direction. If that's something that they feel would benefit, you know, God bless them, and I hope it works. I don't know enough of that mode of transportation. You know, our island is a lot smaller. It wouldn't work here. Mm-hmm. You know, I have my doubts if it'll alleviate any kind of traffic congestion on Oahu, but that's not for me to say. That's something the city and county's got to deal with.
There's a mixture, Councilmember Minor, in what he just said of, you know, resentment of the TAT with a desire to support what's happening from a neighbor island perspective. Can those interests be reconciled?
Well, I'll tell you that the this has been a very divisive and difficult and challenging issue. There's no question. So I agree with Council Chair Raposo on that in that regard. Secondly, I also am very sensitive to the neighbor island's concerns about the use of the TAT to fund rail. And in fact, it's been the consistent position of the city, and more specifically of the city council, that a more straightforward and fair way of funding rail construction would be to just simply extend the excise tax surcharge. It's a tax that's already in place.
Mm-hmm.
It's broad-based. Visitors pay a substantial portion of it. And it again, would ensure the kind of dedicated, committed source of funding that the Federal Transportation Administration is requiring for the city to provide in order for the rail project to remain eligible for the $1.55 billion in federal funding that we need to complete the rail to Ala Moana Center. So I agree, I share Council Chair Raposo's concerns about the use of the TAT. I prefer just extending the excise tax surcharge, and I believe that all the Neighbor Island counties have supported that position. However, we need to be practical and realistic, which in that the legislature is clearly committed to coming up with a funding plan that's going to include the TAT along with an extension of the GET surcharge. So given that reality, the bottom line position of the city council has been that the legislature needs to pay whatever funding plan the legislature comes up with, that it has to generate sufficient revenue to allow for the completion of rail to Ala Moana Center. That won't put the city in a position where we're going to have to consider cutting into core services and programs and or increasing rail property taxes. So that's been our concern going forward, and we'll just have to wait to see what the legislature ultimately passes, and we'll just have to try to make that work on the city level.
It sounds as if you're basically against the TAT tax hike, but willing to go along with it if there's no other choice, if that's what the legislature decrees. Is that accurate?
The preferred approach is to extend the GET surcharge. However, I don't think that that's going to happen. I think the legislature is taking a strong stand that in addition to utilizing GET revenues, that they'd like to also incorporate the TAT into their funding plan. So we have to live with that. We need to try to make it work. But again, bottom line, my concern as council chair for the Honolulu City Council is that whatever the legislature passes, that it has to generate sufficient revenue to allow for the completion of the rail project.
One of the other things that Council Chair Raposo talked about was the $103 million annual cap on revenue from the transit accommodations tax, which presumably is going to be frozen in years to come. And that would mean, theoretically, that as a neighbor island invests more in attracting visitors, it still gets the same share of the TAT no matter what it does or how much it costs them. That would seem to be kind of a regressive tax for them to deal with.
Well, I have a concern about that $103 million cap. I think it definitely should be increased. All of the counties provide important programs and services, infrastructure improvements such as park improvements, road improvements,
sure.
Improvements that help to make our islands more attractive to tourists, and thereby contribute to the health and strength of the visitor industry. So the counties do a lot in supporting our visitor industry. Again, through the programs and services that we provide. So in that regard, I think that the state should recognize that, given the fact that tourism is the primary economic engine for our entire state, that the state legislature should be sharing more of those TAT revenues with the counties.
Well, Council Member, it sounds as if, although there are more than one provision of the bill that's going forward now that you disagree with, it's going to go forward and we're all going to have to live with it. Is that right?
Well that's the reality. I think we're going to have to try to work through whatever the legislature passes and hopefully it'll produce positive benefits for the residents of Oahu.
Even with the flaws that you have described?
Even with the flaws, but there are positive aspects to this bill. I mean, I have to acknowledge the fact that the legislative proposal is going to provide substantial additional funding to allow rail construction to proceed. Another positive aspect of the bill is that a major portion of the funding for the rail project during the years when much of the construction activity along the city center segment of the rail route from Middle Street to Alamona Center will be occurring. And so by adopting that approach, this will be a front-loading of rail funding, which in the long term will save city taxpayers millions of dollars in debt service finance costs. And that's the position or rationale that the legislature has offered for their proposal, and I would have to agree that there are these benefits. However, my concern is whether or not the bill that the legislature is considering is going to provide adequate funding, and all I can say about that is it remains to be seen. And we'll do the city council will do what we can to work with the mayor and the state legislature to try to make whatever funding mechanism or bill that the legislature passes work.
Council Chairman Knorr, thanks very much for talking with us. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Ron Manor is the chairman of the Honolulu City Council and represents Waikele, Kunia, Mililani Town, portions of Eva Villages and Eva Beach. That's it for today on The Conversation. Up tomorrow, a look at the history behind Hawaii's transient accommodations tax and the Maui Academy Performing Arts production of a Victor Hugo classic.
We like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's the number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at High Conversation.
If you missed any of this show or want a past show, well, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Noe Tanigawa.
I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow for The Conversation.